Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. If you've been feeling anxious lately, it's hardly surprising. In the wake of the pandemic, anxiety has hit people really hard, including those who normally don't suffer from it to a great extent. The Anxiety and Depression Association of America, ADAA, says over 31% of us suffer from anxiety on any given day. And they know that those numbers have increased exponentially during the pandemic. They also say that despite being highly treatable, only 36% of sufferers seek help. So we have the perfect guests joining us today. They've lived with anxiety their entire adult lives, so much so that it shaped the work they were driven to do. They're known worldwide as the Anxiety Sisters, and we'll share why in our conversation in just a few minutes. Let me tell you a little bit about my two guests. Maggie Saracek's expertise is counseling and teaching people to find strength through community. As a social worker in a New York City high school, she specialized in the development of youth leadership as well as counseling individuals and families. Maggie's also worked as a special education advocate, helping families to access services for their children and teens. The other half of the Anxiety Sisters is Abby Greenberg. She has 2 degrees in the communication field, a certificate in adult education, and a master's in creative writing. In addition to a 25-year career as professor, Abby has been a divorce mediator, a Myers-Briggs trainer, motivational speaker, and communication consultant. Together, they formed an online community. It's called anxietysisters.com, packed full of resources. Check it out. They've also co-written a book called The Anxiety Sisters Survival Guide, How You Can Become More Hopeful, Connected, and Happy. And that's what we're talking about today. So here are my guests, Abby Greenberg and Maggie Saracek. So I want to begin with a little bit of your background because it's kind of fun, I think. You've been lifelong friends. So Maggie, why don't you kick off? Tell us how you guys met. You met at university. You quickly bonded. How did that go?
Yeah, we met. We were both, you know, when we were both undergraduates at university. And we always say that we were kindred spirits, and I think we recognized in each other that we both were struggling with anxiety, although we didn't have the name for it then. And, you know, we became very, very fast friends and very close friends. And then once we graduated, we stayed extremely close, got even closer. And even though we didn't live very near each other for a lot of the time, we, you know, we always say that after college, our 20s was our decade of the if. You know, we knew that we were struggling, but we didn't know what we were struggling with. So, you know, we both went to the therapist and the psychiatrist and the neurologist and the cardiologist and the acupuncturist and the past life regressionist and any other ifs we could think of,
right,
just to make ourselves feel better. And during that time, well, a little after that time, I eventually went to social work school, and Abby got 2 degrees in communication and became a professor of communication. So, and we stayed close sort of throughout all of this time.
Right, that's a great story. I love to hear those kind of stories. And so, Abby, you have an organization called the Anxiety Sisters. Tell us how you came to form that, and I'm assuming that led to writing the book.
Well, we actually started writing the book before we had the community, because we were writing the book that we needed when we were really at the peak of our struggles. So we had the idea for the book. We just didn't have the Anxiety Sisters piece of it. And that community came about on a bus ride, actually. We were headed from New Jersey to New York, and we were talking, I guess, too loudly about the side effects of our antidepressants.
Right.
And
woman in the seat in front of us turned around and said, "I'm on that same medication. What do you do about those side effects?" And honestly, within 20 minutes, almost every woman on the bus was part of this conversation and sharing very readily very personal things about their anxiety struggles and what they're doing about it. And when we got off that bus, we were walking down 9th Avenue, and I said to Maggie, "Can you believe how easy it was for these people to talk to perfect strangers about something as intimate as anxiety and mental health?" And she said, "Yeah, because it's such a lonely, isolating thing to be anxious, and, you know, people really need community." And then she just kind of announced to Manhattan, "We're the Anxiety Sisters." And it sucks.
Yeah, and I actually thought you were real sisters. There is a, you know, you side
no
by
real sisters, just not biological, just soul sisters.
There you go. There you go. Sometimes that's even better. So let's take a look at what anxiety is and is not, because it wasn't talked very much about, you know, a couple of decades ago in particular. And there's still a little stigma around it. There's still a tendency for some people to say, "Oh, it's just in your head." So we know that the components of anxiety are basically based in fear, but there are plenty of other components that make it up, and it's not one size fit all, as you say often throughout your work. So Maggie, tell us a little bit about what anxiety is from your perspective from writing this book.
Sure, and then Abs, feel free to jump in too. But what we say is everyone has stress in their lives, and everyone feels anxiety. It's one of the human emotions, right? It helps us stay safe when we feel anxiety. Like if we're driving in a car and we're anxious about the weather outside, and it just helps us drive a little more carefully. That is sort of anxiety that will be helpful. But what we really are writing about is anxiety disorder. And anxiety disorder is when our anxiety becomes so overwhelming that it starts to determine who we see, where we go, what we do. Our anxiety kind of takes the lead in terms of the decision-making in our lives. And then it becomes something where it's not just, you know, self-preservation. It's really the determining factor of our lives. Yeah, Maggie had told me to jump in because I'm the neuroscience wonk out of the two of us, and I think she wanted me to toss in my two cents about that. You know, just when you ask what is anxiety, we really like to teach people some real basic neuroscience, just because it's so important to understand that it is a real thing that is located in your body. It is located in your brain, in your amygdala, and in other parts of your brain, and it can show up on an MRI. And that is so important because of the stigma that mental health disorder or mental disorders bring in our cultures. You know, we can't see it, so it gets delegitimized very easily. So, you know, I just wanted to point out that, you know, we have this response called the fight, flight, or freeze response. Most of us have heard of at least fight or flight. And that is the anxiety response. That's when our body goes into stress mode. And when our body goes into stress mode, it does things that it would need to do to prepare to either fight an enemy or to run really fast, like to get away from a saber-toothed tiger, let's say. So that would be rapid heartbeat and a shallow breathing, and your muscles would tense up, all the things you would expect. And the other response we have is the rest and digest response. So when we're dealing with anxiety disorder, we're dealing with people who are spending a lot of their time in that stress response, in that fight, flight, or freeze, and finding it very difficult to get back to the rest and digest. So, you know, that's just something that happens when a part of our brain called the amygdala misfires. And I just like to throw in the neuroscience, because it's really important that people understand that we're talking about a disorder, not a decision. This is not a moral failing. It's not a personality trait, and it is certainly not a choice.
Right. No, I think the science is always important to look at, because it helps us understand that, you know, hey, maybe there's a different solution to this as well. But I also want to throw in there while you're talking about that I hear this constantly. I see it on social media constantly, and it is my big pet peeve. It's very disturbing, I think. And people write all the time things like, "I am broken. He or she broke me. That situation, you know, broke me, and we're not broken.
Mm-hmm. No, we're not broken. We're human. You know, I think that as human beings, we all go through challenges, and a lot of times the challenges are what ultimately brings us a lot of meaning in our lives. They're not fun to go through all the time, but they do give us, you know, getting through those challenges is what gives us some meaning in our lives. And we sometimes forget that, you know, all of us are much more resilient than we think. We have this psychological immune system. And, you know, that helps us get through things even when we are sure we can't get through them.
Right. The other thing that I was glad to see in your book is your dislike of labels. Abby, you talk about how labels can be very reductive and have a very negative impact on us. But at the same time, it's important to understand if we have a medical label, we need to understand that science behind it.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not a fan of labels, and neither is Mags. But we do recognize that this is the way the system works. You get a diagnosis, that's how your insurer will pay for your treatment if you're lucky enough to have insurance. So, you know, we know that the system, there is a system that has to be navigated, but we are big fans of really understanding the labels for the different anxiety disorders and for understanding the right questions to ask so that you don't get pigeonholed or stereotyped, which is what the danger is with a label, is that you'll get looked at as not a human being with a lot of complexity, but, you know, as you said, reductive as a label, a set of symptoms. And none of us are that. We are all human. We all have a lot of complexity.
Yeah. So I want to take a quick look at how it affects people's lives, because, again, that is not a one-size-fits-all situation. It can definitely shrink our landscape. It can feed on itself, make our anxiety even worse, can shape what we do or don't do. So Maggie, talk to us a little bit about that and share how that manifested for you, if you would.
Sure. Well, you know, for me, you know, Abby and I both say that we were probably always anxiety sisters, but, and we struggled, you know, we struggled with anxiety at various times in our life, but I would say for me it got really intolerable about 6 months after my father died, and I was in my 20s at the time. And I came to a place where I could barely leave my house because of I had so much anxiety, which didn't feel like, oh, I'm anxious. It felt like I have a constant stomach flu. Mm-hmm. So at first I thought, I'm having some stomach cancer, or I have a flu, or I have, you know, a parasite in my stomach. Something's happening because I can no longer eat, and I, anytime I do try to eat, it goes right through me, and I'm dizzy and I'm nauseous all the time. And from there, I started to develop a lot of phobias, a lot of transportation-related phobias, like driving and driving in the rain and being on a subway and a bus. And I lived in New York City at the time on the 16th floor of an apartment house, and I was petrified to go into the elevator. So things got very, very bad for me. And I had a job, and it was a job that was probably, in a sense, below what I was capable of doing at the time. And even my job offered me a promotion, but I said no, because I knew that I wasn't in any space to be able to do a more challenging job. I had enough problems just getting to work. And I found that in so many different areas of my life, you know, where I was saying no to things, or I was dreading things that should have been joyful for me. So I talk about how I had U-turn syndrome, which is basically, you know, I was going to a friend's wedding. I was living in New York. My friend was getting married in Boston, and we rented a car, and we were off to the wedding. And I kept saying, you know, I don't think I can make it there. I'm so sick, and I must have a stomach bug. I am so sick. And finally, my anxiety told me to do a U-turn. but I didn't realize I had anxiety so badly at this point. But I did a U-turn and I started to head back to New York. Within 20 minutes, my symptoms resolved. I was like, I guess I am okay. But I say that, you know, my friend was having a dear friend was having a black tie wedding, and I didn't make it to that wedding. I didn't really keep up that friendship after that. And there were just so many things that I couldn't do. My world just started shrinking smaller and smaller. And I think that's really one of the worst parts of having an anxiety disorder, is that your world starts to shrink. And we right. call it shrinking world syndrome. We say some people get full-blown agoraphobia, where it becomes difficult to do anything outside the house. And I definitely had aspect times of agoraphobia. But there's also many of us who get this shrinking world syndrome, where our decisions are no longer our own. You know, our world is starting to get smaller based on what we think we can manage with our anxiety.
Right. That's interesting, because I do remember my mother's funeral. We had a cousin who drove all the way quite a distance and sat in the parking lot. He never came in. None of us saw him. One person saw him sitting in the parking lot, and he just said he couldn't come in. So U-turn syndrome, interesting. So I wanted, one of the things I also liked in there was, you know, I have probably the opposite response if I'm feeling anxious. I want to get out there and I want to go do things. And I loved how you described this, because that's how my anxiety will show up. It's a cloud of restlessness or irritability. For me, it's like a restlessness in my stomach. So Abby, talk to us a little bit about that, because you say another common theme of anxiety is a sense of being on high alert for no apparent reason.
Yeah, sure. We call that the worry cloud. It's sort of this cloud that hangs over you, and you may or may not be consciously worrying, but it gives your body a sense of being very heightened, a sense of being very vigilant. And so you might feel like you had too many cups of coffee.
Right.
You might feel a little shaky, or your tummy might be just a little trembly, like anxious butterflies, or, you know, it would feel like you're on high alert.
Right.
And that's actually the hallmark of what a label that is used called generalized anxiety disorder, or GAD, which a lot of anxiety sisters have received that diagnosis. And that's what it means. It means that you are just heightened. And the reason you're feeling so heightened is because you have adrenaline and cortisol racing through your body.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're in that fight, flight, or freeze.
Right, right.
And you may or may not know that, but you're in it, and your body's response to that is to pump adrenaline in you so you can go run away from an enemy or fight the enemy. So
yeah, it makes perfect sense. And I think that's why my tendency is, and it began when I was going through a divorce, my divorce, and every time I would start, I'd gone to visit my brother, and every time I would start to well up, he'd grab my hand, grab our coats, middle of winter, grab our coats, and he'd run outside with me, and we'd go a long, long walk until it settled down. And so I definitely have that. I would need to get out and run or do something. But
right.
It's interesting how
you're an Aggie, and we both swear by a cold, brisk walk.
Yeah.
Feeling anxious. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially
yeah.
with like that generalized heightened feeling where you're restless or irritable, that there's almost nothing better. It's wonderful that you sort of notice that about yourself, because we know sometimes that flight response can also just make someone feel like they can't settle anywhere. They can't find, someone always described it to me as not being able to find a place for herself. You know, and for her, it would be like sometimes she'd go into a car and just drive for a while, but she couldn't find a place where she felt comfortable. And that was her version of the flight response. So it's really interesting that you noted that for yourself.
Yes, yeah. So one thing we're seeing a lot of now, of course, I think is social anxiety disorder, because we're, you know, going back into or trying to get back into the world, into meetings. You know, a lot of us have been cloistered in homes, working at home, not interacting in those kind of environments, or at coffee shops, and we're suddenly now going back into those. And I've heard from so many people who say they get anxiety just even thinking about entering this. But one thing that I found really interesting, and maybe Abby, you can address this, is that we shouldn't confuse social anxiety disorder with shyness or introversion. And a lot of the introverts I know really enjoyed the time at home, and they're the ones I'm hearing who don't want to go back out. So talk to us about the difference there, if you would.
Yes, but thank you for that question. It's a great question and one that we get often, and it's a really important distinction, because introversion refers to how you get your energy. So if you're an introvert, it means that you get energy from within yourself, which makes sense when that you like to be alone, because that's where you're going to get your energy. And it doesn't mean you can't go out and be in crowds or be with lots of people. It just means that you might feel drained after that and need to recharge on your own. And an extrovert is the opposite, someone who feels energy from other people and the external world, and then they would still maybe want to have time alone, but then might feel drained by that and need to recharge out in the world. So introversion or shyness are very different from social anxiety. Social anxiety is actually a phobia, and it is a fear of being judged or evaluated. And people often think that if you have social anxiety that, you know, you're kind of antisocial or you don't want to be with people. And I have to tell you, our experience talking with thousands and thousands of people over the last decade is that there's nothing further from the truth. In fact, people who suffer from social anxiety are some of the loneliest people, because they really do want the social interaction, but they're so terrified of what they perceive would be judgment or evaluation.
Right.
Or that they might do something wrong or say something wrong, that they're paralyzed and can't interact even though they so want to.
And then that just adds to those feelings of isolation and, you know, feeling alone.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the things we always say about social anxiety is it's not just like, oh, I'm afraid to go to the party because I don't know what I'll say to someone. It can be that. But it can also look a little bit different. It can also look like I can't go out with my friends to eat in a restaurant because, you know, I'm terrified that I will get food on myself or on my top or not eat appropriately, or that I'll get up and have to go to the bathroom and I'll trip on the way. So it's like it's feeling hyper evaluated, I would say. And so it comes out in all sorts of different ways that aren't just like I don't know what to say to people, or I'm embarrassed to talk in front of people.
Right, right.
One anxiety sister that we talked to recently described it in a really beautiful way. She said, it's like having a bright spotlight on you.
Mm.
You feel like you're having a spotlight on you, and you're in that spotlight, and everyone can see every little thing.
Right, and it's no good telling somebody, oh, don't be so vain. It's vain to be self-conscious, which I've heard people say to people in those situations. I mean, it's
yeah.
Way beyond that. So I want to look at some ways to calm anxiety, because just as anxiety isn't a one-size-fits-all, neither is the remedy. And even the tools you recommend in your book, you say, may fit you one day, but another day they may not. And I like to see that, because I was having a conversation with a friend the other day who's very zen and very much into meditation. And I think I've said this on the show before, too, that, you know, I will meditate. I have a lot of tools I use. I will meditate some days. And some days, the best thing I can do is get outside into nature and go kayaking. Other days, it's to, you know, go on a really difficult hike. I mean, it's you have to look at what's going on and what you want to do and how you can best get it out of you. So tell us, Abby, what's your go-to for when you're feeling anxious?
Depends on the type of anxiety. I have obsessive compulsive disorder. That's my main diagnosis, which means that I get stuck sometimes in obsessive thinking, and then maybe I would create a ritual to soothe myself, and I'm much, much better than I was. I've really got it under control. But when that happens, the most soothing thing for me to do, believe it or not, is to actually, you know, do whatever it is that I'm afraid to do, whatever the obsession is. With me, it tends to be something about medical, you know, like I'm afraid that, you know, I, for a while I was worried that I was going to have a heart attack. There was absolutely no reason I should think that. It just was an obsessive thought, and so I was taking my pulse all the time.
Hmm.
And So for me, the best thing to do to calm my anxiety in that situation would be to not let myself take my pulse, go about my business, and just, you know, sort of say, well, if I'm going to have the heart attack, I'm going to have the heart attack, but I can't stop and take my pulse every second. And then if for other types of stuff, for other just restlessness anxiety, then I'm with you about getting outside, especially if it's cold out.
Right, right. And some of the other things you suggest, I mean, you've got a ton of information in there in your book, but some of the other things you suggest, Maggie, might be find a designated anxiety buddy. I like giving one, because I think when we're volunteering, supporting, coaching, serving others, we get out of our own head. Self-compassion. So I'd like you to talk about self-compassion, if you would, Maggie, because, again, I hear a lot of people berating themselves about the way they feel and the way they've coped with things.
Yeah, self-compassion, Abby and I just had Kristen Neff on our podcast, and she kind of is the person who's done the most research on self-compassion, I would say. But self-compassion is something that has been very life-changing for the two of us. And that's the idea, I mean, it's a complicated idea, but that's the idea that you start to talk to yourself in the way you would talk to, say, a dear friend when they were having a challenge or, you know, having any kind of problem. So instead of yelling at yourself like, ugh, I didn't get up on time to go exercise today, you know, I'm mm-hmm. so stupid, I'm lazy, I'm this, I'm that, the things that come to many of us, self-compassion is much more about, you know what, it's really hard, I'm tired, and this is a real challenge. It's maybe a challenge that I want to take on, but I'm struggling with it, and I'm just human, I'm a human being, and I struggle with things. And the reason it's so powerful is that it takes you from what Abby was talking about before, the fight and flight, that kind of, you know, when we yell at ourselves, we often get very revved up, and it takes you from that fight or flight, that sort of defensive place, into a place where, you know, you can just sit and feel how you're feeling for a few minutes, and you're able to use the frontal lobe of your brain, which is where we make executive functioning decisions, which is where we make planning, which is where we come up with ideas. And so the idea of self-compassion is that, you know, most of us don't get better from being yelled at, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we might do what we're supposed to do, but we don't really help ourselves in the long run. We help ourselves when we can be very mindful of how we're feeling, and then, you know, sometimes when we're able to come up with a plan or alternatives for ourselves. So it's not something that so much lets you off the hook, quote unquote, as, you know, research has shown that people do a lot better when they have self-compassion. They've done all sorts of research, like soldiers coming back from war, their PTSD symptoms are much, much less when they treat themselves with self-compassion. Students who failed a test or did poorly on a test, the ones that talk to themselves with self-compassion are more likely to study more for the next test or get some help for the next test, versus students who just criticize themselves.
Right.
Often
isn't that
they
interesting?
End up giving up.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And yeah, we need more compassion in general, all over.
Yes, we need
all around.
And self-compassion does, because part of self-compassion is realizing that you know that we all are just human beings. We all have frailty. So part of self-compassion is realizing our connection
with
other people.
Right. Well, we're almost at the end of our time here. I want to ask you, Abby, how do we know when we get to the point or when we should go see a doctor about anxiety? Because for me, it's just, you know, it's gone in a flash. It's usually because I've drank too much caffeine and I've been running around too much and, you know, haven't taken care of myself. But how do we know when we really need to go see a doctor and we need maybe chemical adjustment with meds?
Well, Maggie and I always tell people that if you think that anxiety is making most of your decisions, then you want to get some help, whether that is seeking medicine or therapy or acupuncture, whatever treatment you're going to pursue. If your life is being ruled by your anxiety, then you want to attend to that, because anxiety, as miserable as it is treatable. You can learn to live really well with anxiety, and Mags and I are living proof of that. We tell people we don't believe in eliminating anxiety, because human beings have anxiety.
Right.
So, you know, that's like saying, I'm going to eliminate sadness. Well, not if you're human, you won't.
Yeah, and it can actually motivate us. It can motivate us if we channel it to improve our lives.
It can. So we don't believe in eliminating the anxiety. We believe in managing it so that you're the one making the decisions about who you'll see, what you'll do, where you'll go. Your world doesn't shrink because of your anxiety. So I would say if you're feeling like, wow, you know, I've been not doing things lately because of my anxiety, or yeah, I'm, you know, I've stopped doing things that I like because of my anxiety, then it's time to get treatment, whether or not it's medication. And medication isn't for everyone. It happens to be for me and for Mags. It's part of our anxiety management plan, but not everybody needs it.
Right. Well, I think if they read your book, they'll get a good idea of where they stand on that. I know you interviewed hundreds of experts in the field, therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists, meditation teachers, etc. You also interviewed a lot of people and have built this community of anxiety sisters. But I'm wondering, in all this research, because you have extensive research in here, I'm going to ask each of you this question. Was there something during the writing of the book and your research that surprised you the most? You've lived with this topic for a long time, but when you're doing your research, did something jump out at you as a surprise? Let's start with Maggie.
I don't know if it was a surprise, but it's something that Abby and I tend to talk about over and over again, which is the power of just being in a community. And I mean, you know, we have a strong community on Facebook, and we do pre-pandemic workshops. Sometimes we do Facebook Lives or Zoom talks. But the idea over and over again is that we hear people sort of say, wow, like, I finally have a place where I don't feel crazy, quote unquote, because people understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not, and so even for all the sort of stigma that has gone away in mental health, the conversation tends to be like, oh, you're okay if you have anxiety, or it's okay to feel not be okay. But when you actually start talking to other people about what the experience feels like, and then practical things you can do in your life to help yourself, like small things that anyone can use, you know, wherever you are with your anxiety, it really makes us feel so much better, that power of community. And we really wrote this book because, you know, we realized how many people like us were struggling, and how
right.
much we get to learn from not just the researchers or the psychiatrists, that's all important, but it's so important to learn from each other.
Right.
And so that message just kept coming back and back and back, and that's really why we wrote this book, with all these stories from people who are also trying to cope with their anxiety.
Yeah, and I think it shows, you know, the variance of symptoms too. And what about you, Abby? Was there something that jumped out for you?
Well, I think it was a personal thing for me. I was surprised at how healing it was for me to write this book. There's been nothing better for my management of my own anxiety and my own OCD than writing this book with Maggie.
You know, there's that saying, we teach what we most need to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And the truth is that I'm a very gregarious person. I have, you know, a wide social acquaintance, and I like to be out in the world. But yet I was also feeling very lonely and isolated with my anxiety. And so, you know, thank goodness I had Maggie. Those 20 years that we were struggling together, we were sort of our own anxiety sisterhood of two. Whereas now we're over 200,000, so it's a bigger group. But I just that sense of having people like you know, my own people.
Right.
Anxiety
right.
sisters. And for us, and
yeah.
for us sisters is anyone of any gender. It's just that our experience is a sisterhood, but we have actually a lot of people in our anxiety sisterhood who identify as male.
Yeah, very good. Well, it's good to hear that collaborating on the book did not cause you anxiety. So, Abby Greenberg and Maggie Sarachek, it's been great talking with you. I think this will really help a lot of people. The book is called The Anxiety Sisters Survival Guide, How You Can Become More Hopeful, Connected, and Happy. And I'm going to ask each of you for a final thought. I know listeners can find out much more about you at your website, anxietysisters.com. And there are a ton of great resources up there, including a panic button in case somebody's having a panic attack. You'll walk them through. But quickly, very quickly, a final thought. Maggie, please.
I guess my final thought is that you are not alone with this, even though it can feel so isolating. There's so many people, you know, in the anxiety sisterhood who understand how you're feeling and who will not approach you with blame or with shame. You know, so come join us in any way that is comfortable for you.
Thank you. And Abby?
I'll just piggyback on what my anxiety sister said, and I would say that when people come together and share their stories and share their experiences, magic happens. So find a place to share your experience.
Great. And of course, a good starting place for that would be theanxietysisters.com. So again, Abby Greenberg and Maggie Sarachek, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having us, Vicky.
My pleasure. I want to end, well, I'm actually going to share a quote that I found on your Instagram feed because I think that's kind of appropriate for this conversation. That's, be patient with yourself. Nothing in nature blooms all year long. I loved that. And I'm going to end by giving the suicide prevention line, which we always do in topics like this. It's 1-800-273-TALK. If anybody has suicidal thoughts or know somebody who's having them or struggling, 1-800-273-TALK is the number to call. And of course, you can go to theanxietysisters.com. They have a whole page full of resources you can reach out to. So thanks for joining us today, everyone. Questions or comments or feedback on today's show, you can find me through our website at conversationslive.net. Please join us next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America, 200 food banks strong.